New school protests over gun violence, this time in a neighborhood that's experienced the violence a lot. And what to do with wastewater. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Two dead, two others hurt. One of those murdered was a student at Miami's Northwestern High School. So is one of those injured. The weekend daytime shooting led to student protests at the school, which has seen four students shot and killed since 2015, none of them on school grounds, though. In Broward County, the school district says it will not arm school personnel, but it will talk about school security in the week ahead. Also, Miami-Dade County opens negotiations with FPL over pumping wastewater into the cooling canals around the Turkey Point nuclear power plant. What do you need to know now? And do you want Florida to live permanently on daylight saving time? Call it Sunshine Time. It's all ahead on the Florida Roundup. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. One student dead, Kimson Green, was a sophomore at Miami's Northwestern High School. He was about to be inducted into the National Honor Society before he was shot and killed Sunday afternoon. According to police, he was just hanging out, talking with friends in front of an apartment in Liberty City when gunfire erupted. Two died, two others were hurt. One of those hurt is a 12th grader at the school. Now, police have not made any arrests in the case. The shooting did not happen on school campus, but on Monday, students at Northwestern held a tribute for their murdered classmate. Junior Rick Pope spoke to the media after the memorial.
There's no love and there's no encouragement from anybody, no willingness to try to make change, and it hurts me to see young students sitting there crying and not being able to get their voice heard or voice any opinion that they have, or at least fight for what they believe in. And it's like all the hope is gone.
Ricky Pope there, a junior at Northwestern, speaking to the media on Monday. A day later on Tuesday, hundreds of Miami Northwestern students walked out and marched to protest gun violence. Police stopped traffic for them. Teachers and staff joined as they walked through the housing project where the shooting happened. In the aftermath of the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas in February, this issue of gun violence in teens certainly has grabbed headlines and has led to policy changes. It led to changes in the law for firearms in the state of Florida. While the two shootings in Parkland and Liberty City certainly are different, they share the trait of young people and violence in South Florida. While Northwestern students marched this week, the Broward County School Board decided against arming school personnel and heard Stoneman Douglas parents upset over the board's response to the shooting. Lisa Olson's son is a freshman at Stoneman Douglas.
Even the President of the United States, the First Lady, the Governor, the Attorney General, the Chief of Staff, and a Senator had the time to hug my son, but not my school district and not my son's principal.
Two different acts of violence, both against teenagers, and much different responses. What role does race play in this? And what is happening with the millions of new state tax dollars earmarked for school safety across the Sunshine State? Let us know your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN here on the Florida Roundup. Time to talk to the community. 800-743-9576. You can also find us on social media on Twitter at WLRN. Nadege Green is with us, WLRN reporter covering education for us. Here at WLRN is Jessica Bakeman and Broward County reporter for WLRN, Katie Swatowski. Also, all three of you, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Nadege, let's talk about this shooting on Sunday afternoon. What are the facts as we know them now?
There's not much that we know. We know that there was a shooting. We know that there were two killed, two injured. The police have not made any arrests yet, so this is one of the many open cases in Miami-Dade County of an unsolved shooting so far.
A case, though, that involves Northwestern High, not because it happened on campus, let's be crystal clear about that, but a sophomore killed, a senior hurt by it, and a third person involved in this shooting, hit by the bullets, was also connected to the school.
Yeah, so, you know, Northwestern, sadly, this is not new for the staff or even for the principal to have to show up to school the next day and put aside really teaching to help students grieve because of something that happened in the community. And they've been doing that. And this isn't the first time. I mean, I spoke to Principal Aristide there, and he was like, he's sure he has the numbers somewhere, but like, how many kids have you lost to gun violence? And I will say that, like, I graduated from Miami Northwestern High School.
Yep.
And when I was in school at Miami Northwestern, there were shootings in the community, and you would come to school to find out that that was, you know, one of your classmates. And so this is not new. We know that gun violence persists in a lot of different neighborhoods, and Liberty City is in one of the neighborhoods. And so when shootings happen, it is bound to affect the students who live in that community.
Absolutely. And it affected them certainly on Monday as they held the memorial for their murdered classmate. They were kept on campus, but by Tuesday, the administration, the local administration, had decided to allow the protests to go to the streets.
Right. The students had expressed that they wanted to go off campus on Monday. And I spoke with Mr. Aristide shortly after, and he said it was a safety issue. You know, he did not want the students taking to the streets or walking through the housing projects without the necessary security, without the schools. He did not want the school to be liable if something were to go wrong. If the students were going to do this, it had to be done in a safe manner. There were critiques about that in the community because there were people standing outside who had heard there was going to be a walkout, and they showed up in support. And so they felt that maybe the students' voices weren't being heard. But by Tuesday, and the school board member Dorothy Bendross-Mendigal had gotten involved as well. But by Tuesday, very quickly, it came together and you saw a show of support across the board, because it's not just the students who are impacted. The teachers are impacted by this as well. They're students. I ran into a young woman who went to middle school with Kimson, and she showed up. She goes to Miami Central High School. We don't consider the networks, right, that there are kids at Central who are impacted by this because they went to Brownsville Middle with him. And, you know, you probably didn't see, you know, counselors show up at Miami Central for them, right?
Right.
So we just saw like a wide range on how this, again, continues to impact the community. And, you know, at least this time, I think the students' voices in a way that maybe before had not been heard on a wide scale was heard.
And I want to talk about that. And Jessica Bakeman, who covers education, I want to bring you in on this because, you know, this is happening obviously through the lens of Parkland now, through the lens of some of the legislative and legal changes that the state lawmakers and the governor have made. And as Nadege has said, this is a community, this is a school that unfortunately has been very familiar with responding to neighborhood violence and its effect on students, on faculty, on teachers, on parents. And we saw the student leaders at Stoneman Douglas step up on social media in a way that perhaps it was much different. We didn't see that kind of other student support for Northwestern students affected by previous shootings. So you can't help but look at this through the lens of Parkland, even though the situations are still very different.
Right. I mean, I think in this community right now, I mean, meaning South Florida more generally, everything kind of feels like before and after Parkland. Mm-hmm. It was such a traumatic event that had such a widespread effect on people. And it is, of course, unfortunate that gun violence that has been happening here for a long time has not gotten the same attention, because obviously it's a crisis no matter where it happens and no matter to whom it happens. But I guess, you know, if because Parkland happened, that means that more people are listening to the students here in Miami-Dade or in other communities throughout the country that have experienced this, then that's a good thing, and hopefully that will continue.
800-743-9576, talking about the shooting in the Liberty City neighborhood on Sunday after and kind of through the lens of students and experience with gun violence after the Parkland Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting in Broward County in February. 800-743-9576. And as you spoke with a number of folks with Northwestern in that community, specifically the students, how are they processing this particular tragedy post Parkland, and are they recognizing that how that lens has changed?
I mean, the students at Northwestern are smart. They know. And even when I went to school there, we often joke that, you know, you get this unofficial teaching in blackness going to Miami Northwestern High School, where we're not just learning about academics, but we're also learning about inequality, and that because you're a school in a certain neighborhood, people are going to view you in a certain way, mm-hmm. that they're going to have preconceived notions about who you are based off of the school that you go to. And so many of the students said outright when I was talking to them immediately, they were like, look at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School and how people respond to the students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. This is not the first time students at Miami Northwestern have raised their voices about gun violence. I know this because I've gone to community meetings and I've seen students talk at community meetings. Some students have addressed our local politicians before. Like, this is not new.
You have held a forum there yourself with students and faculty.
I held a forum at Miami Northwestern High School about gun violence 2 years ago.
Right.
We've seen elementary school kids take to the streets in Liberty City in protest for the right to play outside safely. So this idea that, you know, when we talk about before and after Parkland, I turn that at the media as well, because a good amount of reason why we are paying attention to what's happening in Parkland is because the media is covering it. And we have to be completely honest. We do not cover Liberty City in a way that often centers the humanity of what is happening there. It is typically just a crime story, and that is it. We don't consider trauma. We don't consider what this means to live it.
Right. And the media writ large is committing that same kind of coverage this time around, perhaps more coverage to this specific piece of violence and these two tragic murders and the two people injured, because it is happening after Parkland and through that lens.
And also, here's the difference. Parkland was a mass shooting, right? Where you
on
saw,
school.
On a school campus. The everyday gun violence that we see in our community is not deemed remarkable enough to garner coverage. Right. So oftentimes, and I say that not to say that it isn't remarkable, but we have normalized the abnormal, that one person getting shot is no longer shocking. Mm-hmm. So the shootings that you would see covered typically is when eight people get shot.
Right.
Or when the youngest of the youngest get shot, or 6-year-old or 5-year-old. Right. Then you see a lot of media attention to that because that is remarkable.
Right. Or there's something remarkable about the shooting. It happens on a porch at night.
But on average, we know that disproportionately the people who get shot are young Black boys, teenage to young adult. We don't show up for young Black boys between the ages of 16 and 24 years old. And I think part of it is that there is a perception that you did something to cause your own death, that you are not a quote unquote innocent victim.
And is that conversation, is it beginning to evolve, change at all because of Parkland? I mean, as distasteful as it is to talk about before and after Parkland, the fact is it has changed the conversation.
I think that remains to be seen.
Yeah.
One of the things that I know I've noted as a journalist, as a member of the community, is even like who do the politicians and the faces on TV show up for at the funerals? You'll see them at the funerals of a 6-year-old. You'll see them at the funeral of an 8-year-old. But I talk to parents of murdered children all the time, and they're like, how come the mayor didn't come to the funeral of my 16-year-old boy? How come this public official didn't come to the funeral of my 18-year-old? Because we have a hierarchy of victims, of which victims get more attention or more empathy. And again, let's just say it what it is. Like, young Black boys, teenagers between the ages of 16 and 24 years old, don't typically garner empathy when they are shot unless they are considered remarkable, an honor roll student or a student. But if, you know,
to be inducted in National
Honor Society. Child happened to have, you know, even like a weed charge or something else on their record, then all of a sudden there is this conversation to sort of like just push that away. And we also need to talk about that, too.
Yeah. And we could do it here on the Roundup, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN here, Florida Roundup. Throughout the South Florida area, that's a toll-free phone number. You can also find us on Twitter at WLRN. Jessica Bakeman, I want you to talk a little bit about the kind of the contrast in reaction, even that you saw this week at the Broward County school board meeting, with parents addressing the school board, criticizing the school board for their reaction or lack of reaction, lack of showing up to some places after the Parkland disaster. What did you hear?
I think a lot of parents there are frustrated that since there was this eruption of activism from students, not that they resent the students for doing that and stepping forward, but that so much of the attention was on March for Our Lives, and it was on, you know, changing gun laws in the legislature. And it wasn't on, like, what's happening in the community in Parkland, where students are having to go back to school and they're really struggling and they're feeling very scared and anxious. And, you know, they're just dealing with this. They're really at the beginning of a very long, very difficult recovery. And so what I heard from the parents and the voice that that we heard earlier on the show, Lisa Olson, yeah. Her son William was shot in the shooting, and she said that he has bullets in both arms that he will carry in his body for the rest of his life. And also she said he will carry the emotional scars of seeing three of his classmates die. And there are a lot of kids in that situation. And so what she was saying and what another parent was saying was that the communication just hasn't been there from the school district to the parents to find out what is actually going to change to make us feel comfortable, to make our kids feel comfortable that something like this isn't going to happen again. And Superintendent Robert Runcie said, you know, we've set up these resiliency centers. Obviously, they've offered counseling at different points. And he said that they've done robocalls and they've done social media outreach. But he acknowledged the communication hasn't been perfect. It hasn't reached everyone. And so something they're doing to try to mitigate that is they're having a forum next week on Wednesday from 6:30 to 8:30 at Plantation High School, where people can come and the public will have an opportunity to speak and the school board and the superintendent can address some of their questions. But mainly, like another parent who spoke said, maybe we wouldn't be so angry if we felt like we were getting something other than hot air, but we're just getting a lot of like, yes, yes, we hear you promises, but like we don't see anything actually changing. And no one really feels like they have peace of mind right now.
I want to connect that sentiment, Nadej, to the parents and the neighbors of Northwestern. What Jessica reported on and described here were the Parkland parents directing anger and anxiety toward public school officials in Broward County. There's echoes of familiarity there. Schools, but at public institutions in general.
Right. I mean, I think it's like just a wider spread net in Liberty City where the frustration is at, you know, law enforcement. The frustration is at, you know, the state attorney's office because so many shootings go unsolved. People are like, why aren't these shootings being solved? Because if we were able to get shooters off the street, maybe we would have less shooters. And so it is different in that way. You don't have like one single person. You have City of Miami police, you have Miami-Dade police that are also involved in this. And we've seen that there is an uptick of police in the neighborhood, right? They have saturated the neighborhood right now with police officers, but we know that that is not going to be sustained long term.
We've seen those practices before.
It is a short term solution.
That we saw a few summers ago.
Right. So the question is, right now you see family members who are coming outside with their kids because they're like, for the first time, we feel like our kids can play outside safely because there are police officers outside. And so it's this paradoxical situation of a community that's both over policed and under policed at the same time. And so that is like the conversations happening within the community, which is we don't want to live in a police state, but we do want to live in a community that is safe for our children.
We had a few forums and town halls, both kind of big official ones that were led by members of the Florida congressional delegation and ones that were more community oriented in the days and weeks after Parkland. We had a lot of them in Broward County. We had several of them in Miami-Dade County. What did you hear then, Nadej, in some of those community meetings, both in the Liberty City and the Central Miami area, but you've been traveling elsewhere in Dade County talking to parents.
I just spent like 2 days ago, I was in Gouls in South Miami-Dade, where you've also had like a rash of killings and shootings. I mean, outside the Northside District in Miami-Dade County, it probably has the most amount of shootings outside the Northside District within the county. Mm-hmm. And you had parents, all with the exception of one parent, all of their cases are unsolved. All of their cases are unsolved. We had shootings from 6 years ago, and you had a shooting up to a year ago. And so there is still this frustration that goes like, there is no justice, that you get no justice and you have to live with this pain. Like, how do you live? One mother is raising her daughter's daughter, and she has not told her daughter how her mother died. And so you have this community trauma that is compounded by the fact that you don't feel like you get justice in these cases because the shooters are hardly ever caught.
800-743-9576, community trauma, Jessica. This is something that the Parkland and the Broward community is certainly experiencing. And the kind of coverage that we're seeing in the media, the local coverage of the Liberty City shooting, it can bring up that trauma again, trigger that trauma, no doubt. But it's also part of that important community conversation as Nadej is holding a mirror up to these kinds of reactions. What have you heard? What did you hear at that school board meeting, the meeting that's coming up this coming week? It's focused on school safety, on kind of hardening that space. But what about the softer assistance? I call it softer, but it's not. I mean, the mental health assistance, the counselors that that had been assigned and when were working within the community, do they remain?
Well, I would say certainly stay tuned to WLRN for more coverage of this going forward. It's definitely something that we're focused on. And I don't have a ton to offer at this moment, but just from staying in touch with some of the parents and kids that I met since the shooting,
right.
And just kind of checking in with them every once in a while. Like yesterday, I heard from a couple of moms who had daughters who saw some pretty awful stuff, who weren't physically injured themselves but are really struggling. And, you know, one of them, in both cases, they said the daughters are going to school intermittently. Like, they just are not really able to go to school and feel safe. And they've been continuing to have issues with, like, threats getting called in. And, you know, one of the moms said her daughter, like, wants to wear a Kevlar vest and, like, doesn't really want to leave the house. And when she does leave the house, she gets somewhere and, like, can only stay for 10 minutes and then wants to leave. And in both cases, these moms are just, like, desperately wanting to do whatever they possibly can to help their kids and just feel so lost. And, like, I'm sure that story is multiplied many times over in Parkland and in Liberty City and anywhere that is affected by gun violence.
Nadej, you've spoken to some of those Parkland parents and students, too.
Yeah, and I think also one of the misconceptions is that everyone who attends Margie Stoneman Douglas High School is affluent. That is not the case. And so when we're talking about access to mental health resources, that involves co-pays if you're going through your insurance. I know.
If
you have insurance. Yeah. And I know Katie was at, you know, the conversation about what happens, how is this money doled out? And it was like, if you access mental health services before April 30th, but that is assuming that you were able to do so on your own and were able to pay for it, right? And so, like, that is, like, a conversation that we also hear in, like, the Liberty City community. Again, how accessible is mental health resources? And even if you do get mental health services, like, did it work? We know oftentimes, having spoken to people who have gone to therapists around this, gun violence survivors, they don't always stick with the first therapist they go to because they find that that therapist didn't quite know
right.
or understand their experience. And
yep.
so sometimes you therapist hop
yep.
until you find the right one who works for you.
Yeah, no different than a primary care physician.
And,
yeah.
and in Liberty City, one of the parents in Ghouls, for example, after her son was murdered and he died right in front of her, she tried to go to the clinic for mental health services. The backlog to access a mental health counselor was 6 months.
Yeah, the supply of mental health healthcare professionals.
And
is,
they might need specialized care as well.
Right,
I mean,
right.
a lot of the parents I've talked to have said that their kids are going to trauma psychologists, and obviously to sustain that for as long as these kids might need is going to be prohibitively expensive for many families.
Nadej, you spoke about the formal philanthropy and charity that surrounded Parkland. I want to talk to Katie Swatowski about that now. There's been some development on this, millions of dollars donated in the days after the Parkland tragedy. Which, by the way, kind of signals another difference, certainly, between the Parkland tragedy and what Liberty City, for instance, has experienced just this week. What have we learned about these dollars that were donated?
Absolutely. So that is a big difference because you don't see this $7.5 million fund for the victims of everyday gun violence in right. Liberty City or Goulds. And what we know about that money now is people can still donate through July. But the steering committee in charge of this money is working with the National Compassion Fund. And the National Compassion Fund is going to choose, not based on need or not based on costs or expenses related to medical bills, who gets this money. And there's three tiers to who's going to get it. The most money is going to go to direct family members from the victims.
Mm-hmm.
Then money will go to people who were in the hospital overnight from physical injuries. But then there's this big pot of money left for mental health treatment, psychological trauma. And in order to apply for that pool of money, people will need to have tried to access mental health resources and counseling and prove that they got counseling by April 30th. And that's the way that the draft protocol is written right now. But there's been a couple of town halls for people to ask the committee questions
yeah,
about
what you hear. Where are the questions?
Money. Yeah, so most of the questions come from people who have kids that still can't go back to school. The biggest controversy is, how are you going to decide whose psychological trauma is worse than someone else's? And that's, you know, whether it's a niece or, you know, a grandparent that's asking these questions, it's people saying, how are you going to grade who has PTSD worse than someone else?
Are there answers?
No. The steering committee said right now in their protocol, it's going to be based on, you know, if you can prove that you tried to seek counseling by this deadline, if and how it's the extent to which it's affected you. And they're going to do the best that they can, supposedly, to dole out this money for future counseling. But how far that will go is really a big question right now.
So you mentioned that the fund is still accepting donations, right?
It is, through July. So okay. The idea is for people to continually donate to reach this $10 million goal that the fund has. And most of that's on GoFundMe. But the idea is also for people to start getting this money by July. So it's a pretty tight, quick turnaround timeline for a fund like this. But when you think about victims of 17 families, plus, you know, the 17 that were injured, plus no one knows how many.
Hundreds, if not thousands, of students affected and faculty members. Are faculty also eligible for this?
They can apply for sure.
Yeah.
But it's going to be the process of going through these applications so quickly and figuring out how far $7.5 million is really going to go in terms of helping people afford more counseling.
Lots more to talk about with all these issues. Katie Swietlowski covering Broward County at WLRN, Jessica Bakeman covering education for us here, and Nadej Green, thank you for sharing, all three of you, your reporting with us this week here on the Florida Roundup. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
We have more to come here on the Florida Roundup. Stay tuned. It is time to talk about the environment. Miami-Dade considering partnering with Florida Power and Light to recycle wastewater. What's at stake here? Let us know your questions. 800-743-WLRN. 800-743-9576 as the roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. This week, Miami-Dade County Commissioners voted to begin negotiating a deal with FPL, which could lead to pumping treated wastewater into the cooling canals around the Turkey Point Nuclear Power Plant. There's no deal just yet, just talks, but there are no agreed-upon water quality standards either. Commissioners raised questions about what they were approving with the yes vote. They wanted to know whether yes meant they'd be endorsing a license renewal for two of FPL's nuclear power units, and what water quality standards would be used. Ultimately, District 8 Commissioner Daniela Levine-Cava was the sole no vote on the panel. She wants more time to explore cost-sharing partnerships and potential costs and benefits to Biscayne Bay and coastal restoration projects.
And I say to you in good faith, what is the rush? Why can't we leave enough space and enough time to really explore those opportunities? And then we would have water that would really be good for our environment and not just for the cooling canals.
Environmental advocates and the Florida Keys Aqueduct Authority have said they want FPL to replace the leaky cooling canals with new cooling towers. Michael Soule is an FPL vice president. He responded this way.
We evaluated the opportunity to use cooling towers, and the reality is they're not feasible. They're not economically feasible, and candidly, the most important thing is they do nothing to improve the environmental condition at Turkey Point.
Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez emphasized that the collaboration with FPL would be a win for the county in his estimation. The county is required by the state to reuse 60% of its wastewater by the year 2025.
To me, it's a no-brainer. We have millions of gallons of water that we have to reuse. What better way do you reuse it than recharging, you know, those cooling canals and bringing them back to a healthy ecosystem, stopping the hypersaline plume?
Two problems, one solution here for the environment in South Florida: treated wastewater, cooling canals around the nuclear plant on the edge of Biscayne Bay. Your thoughts, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Our transportation and environmental reporter here at WLRN, Kate Stein, back with us. And also Jenny Stiletovic covering the environment for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from our Doral studios. Ladies, welcome back to both of you to the roundup. Kate, what happened this week with the commission? What did they approve?
So the commission approved an agreement to enter into a partnership with FPL to work on a plan that would potentially solve Miami-Dade County's problem of what to do with this wastewater that it has to deal with. And FPL's problem of working on an ongoing cleanup of the nuclear power plant, the Turkey Point site.
The canals themselves, the canals, specifically.
The canals themselves, yes. And go ahead.
And Jenny, is this a kind of, I mean, it's been seen, perhaps, some would argue, supporters, as an elegant single solution to two problems?
Yeah, I think that using reclaimed water to cool power plants is not unheard of. It's done in other parts of the country. It's just that in other parts of the country, there are not canals next to a pristine bay. They go into these cooling towers. So the hang up here is the quality of the water that you're going to put into the canals, because it's a different system than what's used around the rest of the country. And Biscayne Bay has its own water quality standards, yeah, because it can tolerate, you know, it's like the Everglades. It needs very low levels of phosphorus and nutrients that you find in polluted water. And we know that the canals have leaked. That's been documented. Mm-hmm. So that's why everybody's kind of, you know, saying, hold on, let's address the water quality standard.
Yeah. So why, Kate, is this kind of going forward without an answer to that big question, that water quality question?
Well, Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez was basically like, you know, this, it's too soon to be talking about what water quality standard we're going to address. FPL has said, I think the spokesman that we heard from just now, Mike Soule, the vice president, said something like, you know, we don't need boutique water to clean up our, to cool our nuclear power plant, you know, which arguably that's the case. But there's a question that remains about, you know, what water quality standards are we going to be using going forward? And people like Commissioner Levine Cava and some of the environmental advocates would like to get that fleshed out a little further before moving ahead with
planning. Well, we should also point out, I mean, Biscayne Bay has a water quality standard. Water that goes into the bay has to meet that standard. So I think part of the fear is that if they wait and address the standard after they've designed the plant, you wouldn't be able to tell the water's there until after. The county can't regulate what goes into the canals, only what comes out. But by then, it's too late. You know, the water's already been polluted.
And that's a jurisdictional issue, right, Jenny? As far as who regulates what goes in,
right,
versus what, and who do you know who's responsible for which regulations?
So DERM regulates what?
That's a state agency.
DERM is a county agency, but it has, the state gives it local authority, okay, to issue the regulations.
Okay. And,
but the county could, you know, as sort of an administrative decision, set those standards now for the canal, and that's why some of the environmentalists are pushing them to take that action now and not leave it to state water regulations, which many, you know, people see as not stringent enough.
So let me try to be crystal clear on this. When the water quality question remains to be answered, we're talking about the quality of the wastewater that would go into the canal, or we're talking about what ultimately would result if this were to happen, the water quality in the canal?
The quality of the wastewater going into the canal.
And so these two kind of challenges that these agencies have, the county with its wastewater and FPL with the temperature, essentially, and the water in the cooling canals around Turkey Point. On the wastewater side, Jenny, what's the general source of that problem, this decree that the county is under of 60% of its wastewater by 2025?
Right. So South Florida, because it's old and has old infrastructure, used to have these, or still has these, ocean outfall pipes. They've been pumping treated wastewater out into the ocean, you know, for decades. I think it was around 2008 the legislature passed a law that said by 2025 you have to get rid of these ocean outfalls, because we now understand that that is a pollution problem and damages reefs and marine life and all this other stuff. In newer communities, they have been using reclaimed water for a long time. There are these purple pipes that, you know, you sometimes see in construction, mm-hmm, sites, mm-hmm, and they use it for ag and for golf courses. Down here in our older communities, and especially South Dade, there aren't golf courses, and they can't get it to the ag field, so they have to find another way. And years ago, when FPL was planning to build two new reactors, the county and FPL agreed that they would use the wastewater for the new reactors, but you know, those reactors got shelved last year because of escalating costs for nuclear reactor construction. And, you know, there's a trend in the industry to go away from these big hulking reactors and build smaller, you know, I won't get into
Well, Kate, let me ask you a little bit about those reactors, because, you know, for folks who aren't keeping up to the box score on all of this, you know, the thought was, because the growth of South Florida, certainly the growth in demand, FPL was moving forward with this expansion of Turkey Point. Is that off? Is it paused? What do we know?
Well, Jenny, you might be able to weigh in on this too, but as far as we know, I mean, they got approval. They got the license that they need, I think, for reactors 3 and 4.
Well, for 6 and 7, for the new reactors that aren't yet built, they got approved last week.
And maybe, Jenny, why don't you take this one? Because I think you're a little bit more up to date than me, actually.
Well, right. So last year, FPL said we're gonna postpone construction of the new reactors for at least 4 years because the company that builds them went into bankruptcy and there are all these other problems.
Yep.
And so they have 3 and 4. When they first proposed this deal with the county, FPL also said, oh, and by the way, we are going to apply for an extension for 3 and 4. These reactors were built in the 70s. They were due to expire in 2032 and 2033.
This was an extension of their useful life, essentially.
Yes, to extend the license. So they said, you know, in January they were going to do that. I have to say I'm not sure if they've actually submitted the formal application, but they say that's what they're going to do. As part of that, and this is an issue again with this reclaimed water in the canals, they have been using water from nearby canals to freshen, you know, the cooling canals. They need to show the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that they have a reliable source of water to cool the canals and freshen the canals and address this problem that they've been having with them running hot and creating this massive underground saltwater plume, which is the thing they're trying to clean up now.
In the aquifer. Yeah, let's go to a phone call in Fort Lauderdale. William is joining the Florida Roundup. William, thanks for your patience. Your thoughts here.
Well, for one thing, I'm all for the changeover to using recycled water. Really, you all need to look at other reactor facilities. For instance, the Palo Verde Nuclear Generating Station in Arizona uses municipal recycled wastewater rather extensively for reactors.
Oh, William, you dropped in. You're dropping in and out on a cell line there, but I think you're trying to look to another reactor, the one in Arizona. But I think the challenge of that, and Jenny, you alluded to this earlier, is it's not right on the ledge of a continent of a body of water of an aqua national park, as is the case with Turkey Point.
Right, and a park unique like Biscayne National Park and a bay unique like Biscayne Bay with these low phosphorus levels.
So
he's right, though. Reclaimed water is seen as a really good way to cool reactors as water supplies, you know, everywhere kind of come into question.
Yeah, and certainly in South Dade with the demands from the agriculture community, for instance, with fresh water there, and also the demands further south and west into Monroe County and the Florida Keys Aqueduct Authority. The freshwater supply for the Keys comes right there from you know, Florida City Homestead area. Kate, what are the concerns that the Aqueduct Authority has voiced here?
So the Aqueduct Authority would like to see FPL replace its cooling canals with cooling towers. And the reason for that is there's this plume of salt water, as we've been alluding to, that is being exacerbated by by basically hot, salty water leaking from those canals, pushing the plume of water inland, and that's headed towards the Monroe County well fields, which are located in South Dade. So the Aqueduct Authority and some people actually from Monroe County who were at the commission meeting on Tuesday, they're voicing these concerns about, you know, we want to make sure that what Miami-Dade County and what FPL end up agreeing to, we want to make sure that it protects our well fields as well.
Yeah, does Monroe County have much of a voice in this, Jenny? It is you know, its freshwater supply, as Kate alludes to, is in Miami-Dade County.
Right. I mean, it would be the neighborly thing to do, I guess. I have to say, as in terms of the regulation and who has authority over what, I don't know that Monroe County has any kind of authority Or the Florida Keys Aqueduct Authority has that.
I don't think they have any authority over this deal between, or this agreement that Miami-Dade and FPNL are working on. And I know that the Aqueduct Authority administers those well fields separately from Miami-Dade.
Right.
But, you know, we're all in one ecosystem here. And
we share the aquifer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Turns out. So what are the next steps here? Is the county effort essentially to begin conversation, to begin negotiating with FPL? What are the points that need to be filled in? What are the next steps that we know of, Kate or Jenny?
Now that this agreement has been reached, that they're going to move forward with this, the county staff, they're going to take a step back and, you know, work with FPNL and start developing a plan. The things that we want to hear about, obviously, the water quality standards, that's a big one. How they're going to work out, you know, and at what point in the process they're going to work out with the water quality standards. And then the cooling canals are another issue that environmental advocates and the Keys Aqueduct Authority, they'd like to see Miami-Dade have FPNL switch from the cooling canals to these cooling towers. We'll see if that's going to happen. FPNL has said it's not.
Yeah, it sounds
it
like
doesn't
FPL
make financial
is,
sense
yeah.
for them. And they don't think, based on what the spokesman said or what the vice president said at the commission meeting, they don't think it would make that much difference in the environmental impact.
Jenny, these are awfully complicated issues, lots and lots of issues to work through. What kind of timeline are folks at the county running under, except for the decree of having to recycle 60% of the water by 2025?
Right. So I know Commissioner Sosa asked as one of her amendments that the county report back within at least a year on the progress of the cleanup. FPL says that they want to have the license extension by 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think you have some different plot lines, overlapping deadlines. But they're also, you know, the big picture is the state, which also has some authority, has given FPL 10 years to clean these canals up for good. There's been some comment. I know some of the environmental advocates say that the models that FPL are using don't clean up fast enough and have projected a much longer time frame. Mm-hmm. Mike Soule, who is the FPL vice president, said that their numbers are wrong and that they can get it done by 5 years.
Mm-hmm. All right. You know. Stay tuned. That's right. And more chapters to come. Jenny Stiletovich covering the environment for our part in the Miami Herald. Kate Stein doing the same for us here at WLRN. Ladies, thank you for sharing your reporting with us here on the Florida Roundup. More to come. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. So Florida wants more daylight, at least kind of. The state legislature passed and Governor Rick Scott signed into law an effort that would keep Florida on daylight saving time year-round. WLRN's engagement producer Katie Lepre listened to South Floridians about what difference an hour makes.
When the clock changes, Stan Kamen has to wear a headlamp to deliver mail in the afternoon. If we didn't change our clocks twice a year, he'd be happier. No more headgear.
Just being able to see and not have to use a flashlight, because if you just have a flashlight in your head and your headlights on the vehicle, that's all you can see. You can't see diagonally off side, you know, so well until you're actually on top of the situation. So much better for me.
He wants more daylight. Florida's Sunshine Protection Act aims to give him just that. It would put an end to the biannual spring forward, fall back changing of clocks. Daylight saving time runs from the first Sunday in November until the second Sunday in March. For more than a century, Congress has tinkered with time. In 1974, President Richard Nixon extended daylight saving to an entire year. It was meant to be a single event during the energy crisis. 2 years, that's it. People didn't like it. Florida began fighting back. The state blames morning darkness for traffic crashes that killed 6 students. The last time daylight saving time was changed was in 2007. When Congress extended to what we have today. And now Florida wants to go daylight saving time year-round. David Prairo is the author of Seize the Daylight, the curious and contentious story of daylight saving time.
The sun would rise in some parts of Florida after 8:30. But there are other effects. One thing is, if Florida changed, it would put it out of sync with everybody else, and there's a lot of negatives to that.
Being on Eastern time and in sync with especially New York and the market, that's a big part of my business.
That's Travis McDonald. He's a financial advisor from Oakland Park who works mostly in Broward County. He has clients on both coasts of the U.S.
So during those times of year in the winter months, we're going to be 4 hours different than California, and 3 hours is already a stretch.
That's if Congress approves it. If that happens, Florida will join two other states that have exempted themselves, Arizona and Hawaii. They're on standard time year-round. They don't switch their clocks. Shelley Crawford lives in Delray Beach. She's a landscaper. She wants Congress to approve the change, but doesn't think it'll happen.
Because it won't work. It can't just be Florida. I think that would be extremely, extremely inconvenient.
And better for her landscaping business.
I could get more done. I could sell more plants. I could get more work done. My guys would make more money. They would get probably maybe another hour, at least. That's another 5 hours a week. Everything is relative, you know, to whomever time we're speaking. So there are 5 hours a week. If I have six guys working on a job, that's another 30 hours worth of work that I could have had done. That's a whole, almost a whole week's worth of work for just one, you know, and that's for six people.
Although it's unlikely the proposed time change is on the top of Congress's priority list, there's another option. The Secretary of the Department of Transportation could create a new regulation exempting the Sunshine State from standard time. Will it happen? Maybe. But Congress hasn't voted to change a time zone in over 60 years. Florida isn't the first to try to change its time zones. It follows in the footsteps of Maine and Massachusetts, who all attempted to create legislation around this, with no success. Some of these voices belong to WLRN's Ground Source community. If you'd like to become part of that, text the letters WLRN to 63735. That's WLRN to 63735. I'm Katie Lepre.
Now, finally on the roundup this week, paying tribute to the least poetic definition of where you live, writing an ode to your zip code. Braddock Senior High School teacher Caridad Moro sent us her students' odes.
My students and I wrote zip odes, five-line poems where line length is determined by each digit of one zip code.
Hi, I'm Sabrina Soriano. I live in Miami, Florida.
Hi, my name is Hannah Rosenthal.
Hi, I'm Anna Perez.
And my zip code is 33175.
She is honey, with wildflower eyes, blushing. Pale pink lip gloss stains on warm skin, like Aphrodite in the sun.
Pink cherry blossoms drift ever so slowly. Upon touchdown, memories of the forgotten dissipate with the scattered wind.
I am exhausted, didn't get sleep. Awake, doing work I should have done before. The life of a procrastinator.
I'm Isabel Jimenez. My zip code is 33177. I'm from Miami, Florida. My yellow sneakers smack the pavement. Commuter. The word clings to skin like sweat at corners of brows on late buses.
Hi, my name is Natalie Jarquin. I live in Miami, Florida.
Hi, my name is Victor Ruiz. I'm from Miami, Florida.
And my zip code is 33182. Do you know what you do? How my skin would call out your name if it spoke.
And here's my zip code. The silver brilliance destroying the darkness, moonlight, the romantic embrace of clarity destroying midnight's grip, eternal love light.
Hi, my name is Gabrielle Tola. I'm from Miami, Florida, and my zip code is 33183. My divine femininity, fountain of love, women shred fire like it is water, radiate passion like the sun.
My name is Daniel Rodriguez.
Hi, my name is Nikolai Brantome. I live in Miami, Florida.
My name is Ricardo Emmett Velez. I'm from Miami, Florida.
And my zip code is 33193.
Don't need it. Don't want it. Prom. Come here, m'lady. Please protect me from ego death. I need it.
Culture of hunger. Our Miami is homelessness. Our old man begs for change on Ocho. Turns, smokes his cigar.
Healing hurts too. Stitches still bleed. Hurting, hemorrhaging. Bleeding, pain, all part of the tasking process, all worth it.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Molina. I live in Miami, Florida, and my zip code is 33194. He soars high to a place unknown, but it is his place to wander and discover no one but him.
Hi, I'm Rocio Guardia. I live in Miami, Florida.
Hi, my name is Liam McNear. I'm from Miami, Florida.
And my zip code is 33196. Far from school, far from friends. But although it's far, I never had much of them. I'd really rather stay home anyway.
The apple falls on his skull. Revelation. Cogs in his brain are turning with alarming precision. His apple will redefine all knowledge.
My name is Garida Moro, and I teach at Braddock Senior High School in Miami, Florida. My zip code's 33144. This is what I came up with. I'm their teacher, but also student, absorbing joy, hope, their words, bouquets across my desk.
You can write your own zip ode by visiting wlrn.org/zipodes. And that'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Furtado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Mertz. And our technical supervisor today is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, supporting, and listening to WLRN.